Maybe we can get started again. So the next speaker is Sven Wong from Cambridge. So Sven.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot to the organizers for the opportunity to speak here. It's really nice. I'm going to talk about some work I've been doing over the past months together with Richard, which is on Bayesian computation in high dimensions via MCMC. And so first I'm going to introduce the problem in a fairly general framework. And in the second part of the talk, I will speak about the main results which we can obtain for a specific PDE model, which has to do with an inverse problem for the Schrödinger equation. And in that course, I'll also try to mention some proof ideas. And I don't know how far we get, but I hope to be able to mention the main ideas. Okay. So just to give the general context, we're going to consider sampling from a posterior distribution. And for now, the posterior distribution will just take the form that it's prior times likelihood. So we'll denote the prior by pi, and e to the ln is the likelihood. So ln is the log likelihood. And a very popular thing to do is try to sample from this posterior distribution pi of theta given zn using MCMC. And the data will be denoted by zn. All right, so pi is the prior, ln is the likelihood. Okay, and I want to consider a setting where not just n grows while d stays fixed, but actually I want to consider a high dimensional setting where they may have some simultaneous asymptotics. So you can think of d, for instance, growing as a polynomial power in n, which means that the sampling problem will probably become harder as a result. And also I want to consider the situation where ln arises from, vaguely speaking, a complex statistical model. So for instance, if I have a nonlinear inverse problem, what this will cause is that ln may, you know, may be non-concave. And as a result, the posterior measure may be multimodal or non-log concave, which also causes the sampling problem to become harder. And then I want to ask the question, well, there are actually two questions. A, I'd like to generate a random variable theta, just so that, you know, the law of theta approximately equals the target measure of interest, the posterior distribution. So that is literally generating a sample. But I can also ask other questions which may, you know, come from statistical motivation. Namely, I would like to perhaps compute some aspects of the posterior distribution, such as, you know, integrals against the posterior distribution. So here, for instance, h, if that's a real valued function, then this would be like a one dimensional integral against pi. And I could also try to compute the posterior mean vector. So that's a vector valued integral where for each component, I'm just integrating the posterior measure against the kth coordinate projection. Okay, so that's a vector in RD. And obviously that's a quantity of statistical interest because I would like to perhaps use it as an estimator for the unknown theta. And then as a third object, I might consider also, you know, optimization-based estimators. So I would like to compute the mode of the posterior density. And all these computational tasks, I'd like to do with whatever it means for now, reasonable computational cost. So obviously I, for instance, wouldn't like the computational cost to grow exponentially when sample size or and or dimension grow, okay? And I'd also like to just briefly recall the idea of Markov chain Monte Carlo, or in short MCMC. And the basic idea is that given that I can't, you know, directly generate a sample from my measure of interest, this measure pi, what I can do instead is I can generate a Markov chain, which will throughout be denoted by var theta k. This Markov chain lives on RD, which is the parameter space, and it's ergodic. And I'll design it in such a way such that the unique invariant distribution of this Markov chain theta k is the target measure. And because it's ergodic, that means, that no matter where I start off with, I'll converge to the invariant distribution, all right? So then these two computational tasks that I just mentioned, when you have such a Markov chain, can be naturally addressed. So remember that task A was just to generate a sample whose law is approximately equal to the target. And that I can do by simply letting the Markov chain run for long enough. So that's the notion of the mixing time, say J mix, okay? And after I've waited enough steps, when K is larger than that, then the law of theta K will approximately be equal to pi. And the second task, which is kind of the numerical quadrature task, so I want to compute integrals against the posterior distribution, can also be addressed when I have such a Markov chain. Namely, first of all, I again need to wait until the distribution is close to the invariant distribution. And then I collect J samples and I average evaluations of the functions, the function I'd like to integrate against. So for instance, H, a real valued function, I evaluate that along the Markov chain and the average will approximately again be equal to the integral of interest by the ergodic theorem, all right? And of course, now the question is quantitative because my measure is changing with N and with D. So of course, in order to say that I can do this with reasonable computational cost, a more precise formulation in the context of MCMC is how does the mixing time and how does the number J of samples I need to average against, how do they depend on D and N? And there are many ways to argue about computational complexity, and I guess a fairly rough but very fundamental way is distinguishing whether you have exponential computation time or whether you have polynomial computation time. And this is the way we're going to think about it without thinking very precisely about the exact polynomial dependence. Okay. And I'm going to look at a specific class of statistical models from which I have observations, which are integration models or inverse problems if you want. They're going to be fairly synonymous in this talk. So I have a domain O, which is a bounded subset of R to the little d. And then I have a regression model, which basically just means I have a parameter space theta. And for each theta, I get a function on this domain O, which I can observe with noise. Okay, and then theta is the unknown. And I'd like to recover theta or even just the regression function is also interesting. So the data I'm given is Zn, which consists of yi and xi. And it is precisely what I just said, that you have g of theta, which is the function on O, and you're evaluating that regression function at a point xi, and then you add random noise to it, the epsilon I. All right? And here the xi's are assumed to be sampled uniformly over the domain, and the noise is assumed to be Gaussian. And this is just the random design regression model that, for instance, Botond also mentioned in his talk just now. Okay, and a very important class of maps G arise actually from applications with partial differential equations. Which is, for instance, whenever your model is modeling any physical phenomena where theta and your data are related through a physical phenomenon such as heat diffusion or transport or many other things that are described by PDEs. This is what motivated this work, and we're also going to look at an example from PDEs in a second. And the trouble with some of these maps, or many of these maps, in fact, is that they're often nonlinear, which of course poses some additional difficulty. Okay, so I can take a Bayesian approach to try to address this inverse problem. And one very popular thing to do is I can just place a Gaussian prior with centered Gaussian prior with covariance sigma on my theta parameter. And then I'll get a posterior density which just has this form where the first part, this one, comes from the log likelihood. So that's just the Gaussian likelihood. And here I have the log prior density. All right. And in the Bayesian approach, I'd like to use this posterior distribution, whatever aspect of it, to do inference on theta. And translated into numerical language, that exactly means that I need to compute some quantities of the measure which has this density, be it the mean or the maximizer or its quantiles. Again, as I said a second ago already, so when G is nonlinear, you can see from the form of this term that this then in general may not be convex. And when this is not convex, this function ln, the measure pi altogether may not be log concave, which is one of the sets of conditions that have been invoked to get polynomial time guarantees, which then unfortunately will not be granted in this setting when G is nonlinear. And there's another thing that's of course happening, as most of you know, is that when sample size increases, your measure will become increasingly concentrated around some parameter, say if it comes from specific ground truth parameter. But actually you can already see it here that the likelihood term is a sum of n terms. So if, for instance, the likelihood is multimodal, and you're summing n terms that are all multimodal, and they concentrate around some expectation, it could happen that you actually have local optima of growing depth in n, which can be an issue for many MCMC algorithms. Okay, so there are all these kind of scaling phenomena going on, and even though it's very hard to show rigorous negative results to say that MCMC for sure will have exponential mixing time in a general class of models, there's a lot of actually folklore wisdom in this direction saying that that without further assumptions, at least on G or on the target measure you're sampling from, in the kind of non-log concave case, it's very hard. And there's kind of a curse of dimensionality. Okay, for instance, here are some references that say that when you have a d-dimensional measure that you're trying to sample from by using particle filters, you'll probably need an exponential number of particles. But there has been a very nice a couple of papers and work on this problem, on this curse of dimensionality. So there have been so people have looked at how to get a more favorable dependence on dimension. And first of all, I'd like to mention there's a very nice paper on the preconditioned Crank-Nicholson algorithm by Heira, Stewart, and Vollmer, where they derive just under a general condition kind of on the log likelihood function, and as well as like another abstract condition on acceptance probabilities of the Metropolis-Hastings scheme, they develop a dimension independent spectral gap property of the relevant Markov chain, which basically means that you kind of have an underlying infinite dimensional problem in function space, and the mixing properties of the Markov chain considered do not depend on which high dimensional level you truncate at. Okay, and then for another very popular class of algorithms, which are Langevin algorithms based on discretizations of diffusion processes, there have also been a number of papers. So in the log concave case, starting with work by Arnac and then Delmuse and Moulin, where they derive bounds that depend polynomially on, for instance, the curvature of the measure or the Lipschitz constant of the gradient of the potential. And then subsequently, there have been attempts to generalize this to various settings where you do not have to assume log concavity. And for instance, Vampala and Bibisono have a preprint from last year where they directly assume that your measure somehow satisfies a log Sobolev inequality, which is implied by log concavity. So it's really a weaker assumption. And they get mixing bounds under this assumption. And there's another reference by Ma Chen and Michael Jordan and others, where they assume that the measure you're looking at is log concave just outside some Euclidean ball. Okay. But the problem now is as soon as you leave the log concave setting, there will start to be dependencies, more subtle dependencies on other parameters, which kind of quantify in what sense and how much you are not non-log concave. And if you take any of these results and actually try to apply it to a genuine statistical setting where your posterior measure comes from data, then it seems, at least to the best of our knowledge, when we tried around with all of these existing bounds, that the mixing time will depend exponentially. And to illustrate this, I'd just like to make a little drawing on the next slide. How you can think about it is, in some sense, for instance, Haider, Stewart, and Format depend very nice, derive very nice bounds, which are dimension independent, but actually implicitly depend on other parameters. And then when you have a statistical model, you actually have simultaneous asymptotics of a lot of quantities at the same time. Okay. And to illustrate this, I'm going to take a very basic example, which is taken from a paper by Eberle in 2015 in PTRF, where it's just a one-dimensional case. So theta is a one-dimensional parameter that lives on the real line. And you have a potential like this, okay? So the example is about Langevin-based Markov chains, which, so when you use such a scheme, what you'll do is you'll discretize the diffusion process, and the diffusion process moves in a potential, which is the logarithm of the target measure. So think of this measure as the logarithm of the target measure, okay? And then one way to think about the mixing time, or to lower bound the mixing time at least, is to say, well, if I have such a double well, let's say symmetric around zero, if my diffusion kind of is on one side, so say I start over here on the right-hand side and moves around in this potential, how long does it take to hit the point zero? So that's kind of the time tau zero. How long does it take to get here? Because in order to mix, I at least have to cross this point to get to the other side to kind of explore both halves of the support of the measure. And what can be shown is that this tau zero time and the height of this potential well depend exponentially to each other. So that means when you have like multimodality with worse local minima in the sense of they're higher, at least if you use a naive Langevin scheme, the mixing time will depend exponentially. Okay, and that's not a phenomenon of growing dimension, but that's a phenomenon of increasing irregularity of the measure, if you want. So okay. So ask the what additional structure of the posterior measure when it actually comes from statistical model can you perhaps use in order to prove polynomial time computation bounds? And indeed, we'll use a couple of aspects that these models carry. So for instance, we'll use some local information geometry, which is kind of just that locally you can say something about the curvature of the posterior. There are concentration of measure phenomenons going on, and of course, Bayesian non-parametrics that you know the posterior measure will concentrate around certain regions around the truth. Okay, so everything I say from now on will somehow be specific to an inverse problem for the Schrödinger equation, but I just want to say at this point that we do also have general considerations to a certain extent that generalize to other problems. Okay. So now I'd like to specify kind of a concrete nonlinear forward map G for the inverse regression model. So again, I have a bounded domain O, and as part of the assumptions, I'm given a function G, which is defined on the boundary of the domain. Okay, and it's strictly positive, and it plays the role of a boundary value function in a relevant PDE. Okay, so which is the relevant partial differential equation that gives me the forward map? It's this one. So for every function f, I get mapped to a function uf, and uf is the solution to this partial differential equation, which is the Laplace operator of u divided by 2 minus fu is 0 on the domain, and then u has the prescribed boundary values. And you can think of this, for instance, in terms of f being a potential that an electron moves in, and then this is kind of a steady state version of the Schrödinger equation for the electron. And there's no time derivative here, and that's why it's called steady state. Okay. And just a couple of properties that this map G has. Well, so first of all, if F is sufficiently regular, this coefficient that sits inside the PDE, then you get a unique solution of this PDE just by elliptic PDE theory. So this is well defined. Okay, and moreover, G is nonlinear. And this can be seen, for instance, when you look at a probabilistic representation of the solution of this PDE, which reads as follows, that for a potential f here, the solution uf can be represented as kind of an expected value over some Brownian motion moving in your domain. So, so here, xt is a d-dimensional Brownian motion. So say this is your domain O, and you start your Brownian motion at some point x, and it'll almost surely at some point hit the boundary, and it'll hit the boundary at some time to. Of course, when you're averaging over all such paths where it hits the boundary, it'll hit the boundary at lots of different points. And then when you average the boundary value g over such hitting points, then you can represent the solution of this equation. And this is a weighted average, and the weights here are the thing that introduce nonlinearity. Because in some sense, if you have a path xt and it moves over a lot of places where f takes a very large value, then the weighting is like e to the minus f integrated along the path. So it's kind of that there's an exponential clock ticking which kills the Brownian motion if f takes very large values. Okay, so that's why this is sometimes also called attenuation, perhaps, and this is where the nonlinearity comes from. And you can see that while the solution depends linearly on the function g, which is the boundary data, it depends nonlinearly on the coefficient f. Okay, and I've only told you part of the forward map g, because in order to use a Gaussian prior, I need to actually parameterize this by like some high dimensional vector. And there are two things I need to do in order to do this. So first of all, I need to somehow pick a discretization of a function space by something high dimensional. And one natural way to do this in the context of these elliptic PDEs is to use the Laplace operator on my domain O, and then just use eigenfunctions of the Laplace operator and pick a basic expansion that I truncate at d elements. Okay, but then also, and this comes kind of from the PDE structure, it makes a lot of sense to assume that f is non-negative, similar as it makes sense to assume f is non-negative in density estimation. So that's why I have a second step in the parametrization, which is I use a regular enough link function, and I simply concatenate this f theta function, which is the finite basis expansion, with this phi function, which ensures positivity of the parameter. Okay, and then finally, my forward map is just given as theta in RD mapping to the PDE solution, which corresponds to a G of little f theta, where f theta is kind of the positivity transformed parameter. All right. So for this map G, let's just recall, for this map G, I'm considering now the problem of sampling from this posterior distribution. Okay, and in the results which follow, we'll also assume that the data is generated from some ground truth parameter theta zero. Okay, the first theorem I will describe is regards a computation of the posterior mean. And the theorem is somewhat qualitative in that it assures existence of a polynomial time algorithm, which I will describe after, which precise algorithm actually achieves this. So I need some, we need some mild regularity assumptions that the model dimension doesn't grow fast enough, and that the prior and the ground truth are in a, you know, in a somewhat usual way compatible with each other. And then, okay, then I prescribe myself some precision level epsilon that I assume, to be polynomially decreasing at most, where, but P can be anything. Okay, so here I take some epsilon to which I would like to compute things. And then the theorem says that there exists a sampling algorithm with computational cost at most depending polynomially on N and D and epsilon inverse, such that with high probability, I can compute this posterior mean vector. So in RD distance, the posterior mean vector and the output of the algorithm are at most epsilon apart. And the probability here is taken under the joint law of the data Zn, as well as the randomness of the algorithm.
Sven, can I ask a question? It's just I must have missed something. What's the p in n to the power minus p in the lower bound of epsilon?
Oh, that's just that I, so p is something you choose. And then you you say that the precision level is larger than n to the minus p. So p is something new on this slide. So I'm just saying without, so in some sense you're picking some simultaneous asymptotics of N and D and epsilon. And I'm assuming on these asymptotics that epsilon doesn't decay too fast in relation to N.
Okay, and so in other words, if you wanted to match the precision of your algorithm with the precision of the statistical procedure, for instance, you would need to know P in advance to construct your algorithm, or does the algorithm not depend on P?
Yes, so the algorithm, well, you can pick any P here. And you can, in particular, actually, this is in some sense without loss of generality. So you could even choose epsilon to just have an exponentially decreasing bound. But then one would have to quantify what kind of exponential you would have. So you can certainly, you can specify an algorithm that works for all p simultaneously, if that, if I got your question correctly.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, so now I'm going to describe the particular Markov chain which achieves these bounds. Will be denoted by theta k again. Okay, and the first step, so I should say in the beginning that this is a Langevin type Markov chain, which is related to the unadjusted Langevin algorithm in some key aspects, or it's, but it just has some like specific alterations of it. And the first, you know, key thing is that you need to initialize in a specific way. You need to initialize at something, of course, that is computable in polynomial time. And I'm not going to say a lot about the initializer, but it'll be denoted by theta in it. And I'll say that what it involves is that it involves solving a convex optimization problem kind of on the direct level of the problem, which is of at most polynomial dimension D, polynomial in N, so that you can do this in polynomial time, okay? And once you have your initializer, you're going to construct a likelihood function, a proxy likelihood function, L tilde N, around this initializer. And this proxy likelihood function L tilde N will agree locally with the original likelihood function. And it takes the following form, that you start off with the original likelihood function, then you multiply it by some cutoff alpha that kind of cuts you off when you're far away from the initializer. It subtracts some strict, some globally convex function, so that, I mean, think of ln of being concave. So away from theta in it, this will be concave. Okay, and the region on which actually ln and ln tilde coincide is kind of a non-asymptotic region in D and N, which is an L2 ball around kind of the truncation of the truth. Okay, and it has a certain radius in D and N. And then when you have this proxy function, okay, you can just form a proxy posterior distribution from it. Of course, you can just say, okay, I multiply pi with either ln tilde. From that, I can take the logarithm, and then I get a potential that I can run my usual Langevin scheme in. And that's precisely what we do. So, okay, now I specify a step size, and I have some noise variables, zeta k. And then the Markov chain I consider will be given at, I start at the initializer, and then I kind of move just along this potential according to the tilde pi. All right. So this of course has an interpretation, because this is the Euler discretization, a discrete time version of a continuous time diffusion process, which just moves which has the gradient of the log pi tilde density as its drift vector field. Okay, and it's well known that that this continuous time diffusion process will have the invariant density pi tilde. Okay, and of course now if you have invariant density pi tilde, it's not given that you can actually that this algorithm will compute anything that has to do with the posterior, and that's actually what you have to prove by using Bayesian nonparametrics. So this kind of but it is really a lot of the meat that you have to do in the proofs. It's not a sampling bound itself, but it's very important to obtaining the sampling bound. And what this result says is that with high probability under the data, you have three assertions. So let's start with the first one. The first assertion is that the posterior density is actually locally log concave on this region B, where ln and ln tilde coincide. Okay. And by virtue of analyzing the map estimate, you also get that actually the posterior mode is unique, which is not clear a priori in a nonlinear problem at all. Okay. And the second assertion is that the tilde density is not only locally log concave, but because of the convexification with this G function going on, it's actually globally log concave. And it also has the same unique mode. Okay, and the third part is now the key thing, which is a global approximation result of the posterior measure by this proxy posterior construction in Wasserstein distance. And this shows that with high probability under the data, these two measures are really close up to negligible error. Right? And some more words about this proxy measure. So first of all, I think it's a very interesting fact that though the proxy density is globally log concave, it's not necessarily a Gaussian distribution that you're approximating by. So it is, you know, it is in particular not a Bernstein von Mises approximation. But in some sense, it's a little more non-asymptotic, because whatever the likelihood function is on this non-asymptotic ball B, this region, you're leaving the likelihood function as it is, but you know that it has local curvature, okay? And then outside, you're just convexifying it. Okay, and in order to prove this, you need a couple of proof ingredients. So first of all, you need posterior contraction theory with Gaussian processes, which was developed by Art and Harry van Zanten. Also, this was done recently in nonlinear inverse problems, and we need also techniques from there, which is the paper that Gabriel spoke about yesterday in parts. Okay, and then on top of that, you also need to make a detailed analysis of the map estimate, and actually you need to show some concentration properties of the proxy distribution as well on this non-asymptotic region. Okay. And then, okay, so given that I have about 5 minutes, Ismail, is that correct? I have about 5 minutes?
Yes, correct.
Okay, so I may skip over these proof ideas, even though they're important. So the main message from this slide is the following. I think I'm gonna just mention it briefly, is that there is a general property that you can assert in inverse problems, even if they're nonlinear. You can still say something about their average curvature, at least in a neighborhood of the true value. And where that comes from is basically that if you take the Hessian of the expected likelihood function, okay, what you'll get will be basically two terms. It'll be one term, which also in a little, which is a gradient of the forward map. Okay, and you have yet another term which becomes small around the true value. Okay. And this is not just a property of the model, but it is a property of the model together with the data generating process. And then, okay, so if you want to assert that your model has local curvature, what you'll need to do is, in some sense, you'll have to lower bound the first term here, and you'll have to somehow control the second term that is dominated by the first term, okay? And lower bounding this first term here, so here I've evaluated the Hessian matrix at some test vector V, basically means I need to have like a stability estimate for the gradient, okay? And that's what we use. And in the Schrödinger model, one can do this using elliptic PDE techniques, okay? And what you can get from this then is that you can get polynomial time sampling bounds for this Langevin-Markov chain on the proxy posterior, okay? So I just need to introduce some hypotheses where epsilon is again precision level. And given epsilon, I'm choosing a specific step size, gamma epsilon. And the main message here to take away is that the step size depends polynomially on all these quantities of interest, n, d, and epsilon. And then I need some regularity assumptions on the dimension, and I'm gonna go fast because I'm running out of time. And this is notation I need to introduce. So here, mu j mix j is just the ergodic average of a functional along the chain of some one Lipschitz function h, and theta bar j mix j is going to be the ergodic average estimator kind of for the posterior mean. Okay, and what I get from that then is the following theorem. Okay, so you can regard this as a more precise version of the first qualitative theorem I gave. So that's concentration inequalities for ergodic averages. So this says with high probability under the sampling distribution of the data, okay, I have the following, that the Markov chain theta k satisfies that the ergodic averages are kind of close to the true quantity with high probability. So take for instance this, this one, this asserts that mu j mix j being away from the kind of true posterior mean more than epsilon has a vanishing probability also under the Markov chain probability. Okay, and of course here there are two crucial things. So you need to track how j mix depends on d, n, and epsilon inverse. And they depend on, this is a polynomial dependence. Okay, and similarly here, how long do you have to let J run in order to get really a vanishing probability? And this is also polynomial. So in this sense, we prove polynomial time convergence guarantees. And you can also show that then you can compute the truth up to whatever statistical precision the posterior mean possesses. And this is my last slide I'm gonna show, which is a convergence of, which is going back to task A, where you're just trying to generate a sample that approximates the law. And for that, you need to introduce a distance, Wasserstein distance on the space of probability measures on RD. And then you get this theorem that the Wasserstein distance between the law of the kth member of the Markov chain and the posterior distribution has a geometric decay, which is this first term, plus, and this is the key term, plus a discretization error epsilon. Okay? And the key thing here is that the geometric decay, so the one minus something to the k, the something has to decay at most polynomially in n, d, and epsilon inverse, and that's the case. And so in particular, you can get polynomial time Wasserstein approximation up to level epsilon. Okay? So you can think of this as a spectral gap, and epsilon is the discretization error, as I already said. And I think that's all I had time for, but that was anyways 95% of what I wanted to say. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Sven. We have time for maybe one or two quick questions.
Yeah, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. So it's a very nice work, but I have a question. So at the beginning, it seems to that you said that your algorithms depended on the true value of the parameter. Somehow you center it around it, or like with this definition of the set B, or did I misunderstand
the B set? Yes, that's a very good point. So the algorithm does not depend on the true parameter. It's only the analysis of the algorithm that depends on the true parameter. Okay. So the algorithm will know the initializer, and yes, it is important that the initializer is sufficiently close to the truth, but does not have to be close kind of in a statistical minimax sense. And then the algorithm only needs to know the initializer.
Okay.
But you will know that a neighborhood of the initializer kind of has local curvature, and that is by virtue of knowing that that neighborhood is also close to the truth.
Can I have also a quick question?
Sure.
So very nice result, and I like this line of research very much. I was wondering that exponents, this b1, b2, you didn't give us, and I guess they are. You didn't optimize them, but and probably they are big, right? So okay, so let me rephrase the question. How practical are these algorithms? Did you try it out empirically?
That's a very good point. We haven't tried it out empirically. So I think the starting point was that just to investigate whether you can sample in polynomial time from a theoretical perspective. I think B1 and B2 and B3, even though they're, big depends on what one thinks is big, but you can, they're not like 100. They're more like maybe 9 or 10 or something like this, which of course in practice is a lot.
Yes, probably if you have cubic, then already it's a problematic, right? So.
Yeah, but I think there's also a number of ways in which you can try to accelerate actually Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithms. For example, you can try to precondition. You could of course try to rescale the measures so it has some more stability. But all these questions from a theoretical perspective were not entirely clear for us how to make this rigorous. And in practice, I think there is. More ways actually which are very interesting in which you can try to speed up the computation to grind out the best polynomial mixing time.
Thanks. thank you very much again. Maybe we can have a short 3 minutes break and start at 11:07 in the UK. So in 3 minutes.
Thank you.